In closing, I'd like to address you on four areas, and they reflect the terms of reference of this inquiry. The first of them is the adequacy of policies and practices for the safeguarding of children within Ampleforth and Downside. Secondly, the evidence heard by the panel of the sexual abuse of children at Ampleforth and Downside. And thirdly, the extent to which the culture within those institutions has inhibited the proper investigation, exposure and prevention of child sex abuse. And then lastly, what should be done about it? So firstly, the Catholic Church has commissioned three key reports on the handling of abuse allegations. As you'll know, there's Bishop Budd's Working Party, reported in 1994, the Nolan Report, published in 2001, Cumbridge Report, published in 2007. And over the period of those reports to now, the Catholic Church, in my submission, has sought to give the impression that its child safeguarding has improved further with each one of those reports. But that impression has been undermined repeatedly by the evidence heard in this module. Adrian Child of COPCA summarised the position very well earlier this week. He said, since 2006, and possibly even before, the statement of the church hierarchy has always been that the needs of victims and survivors are up front, and it is a priority for the church to establish sensitive and just responses to them. Now, this is within their gift. If it's been a priority for since 2006 and possibly before, it strikes me that how come in 11 years they've not managed to achieve that? Well, there are many reasons why the church hasn't managed to achieve it. One is related, in my submission, to the structure and hierarchy of the English Benedictine congregation. The EBC, as we've heard, is a confederation of independent monasteries, and each of those has been described as a family, with monks, as a general rule, almost never leaving one monastery for another. Individual abbots, it seems, run their own fiefdoms. Overarching positions of authority within the EBC have no real teeth to influence these fiefdoms. It follows that those in senior positions, such as Abbot President Jameson, who are more likely to be in the public eye and inevitably less old-fashioned and more media-savvy than the local leaders, are effectively hamstrung by the hierarchy within which they work, even in relation to the safeguarding of children. Turning to the evidence given by the survivors was plainly compelling. I'm going to focus on the evidence of A30 and A117, both of whom I represent. A30 spoke emotionally of being groomed at Ampleforth, being repeatedly sexually assaulted, and then feeling guilty for what had been done to her. Her abuser started by informing her that she was special and beautiful. He started to comment on her breasts frequently, often in front of other pupils. Then, as A30 put it, he became more tactile publicly, with things like snapping my bra strap in front of other members of staff. As no one said anything, they clearly knew what was going on. It gave him more power. He obviously liked it, and he grew in confidence in that area. He could get away with a lot more in public because he was getting away with more in public. Nobody was doing anything. It's hard to imagine that conduct occurring in front of other staff in a state comprehensive school. And if it did, one would assume that the repercussions would be swift and grave. Why should Ampleforth College be any different? The abuse escalated, led to A30's evidence that she was tied up and left in the Ampleforth woods, and her abuser subjected her to increasingly aggressive sexual assaults, all of which she was brave enough to describe in detail, you'll remember, to the panel. She went on, though, to say that the child protection policies at Ampleforth were seen not primarily as being about protecting children, but about protecting the reputation of the institution. You'll remember, she said, the emphasis seemed to be almost entirely on box ticking, filling out forms, getting the paperwork done, the bureaucracy. Child protection actually became much less, in my experience, about what was best for the child, and much more of a focus on what the school should do if a false allegation, or any type of allegation, were made against the staff. In other words, Ampleforth's child protection policies permitted her abuser to hide behind safeguarding documentation, whilst he continued to abuse her in plain sight. As for Downside, it may be said by other representatives on behalf of the EBC that the evidence of A117, whom you'll remember, isn't relevant to this inquiry because it was concerned principally with the abuse inflicted upon her by a member of the church after her 18th birthday. You should reject any such contention. She was clear in her testimony that her abuser, whom she described in shorthand as F80, first gained access to her while she was hospitalised and still a child. which in my submission means her case falls within this inquiry's terms of reference. She said she'd been taken by her parents on a pilgrimage to Lourdes by a Roman Catholic organisation of which her abuser was at the time a chaplain. She was 17 years old and described herself at the time as being pretty broken. I'd been in hospital since the age of 10 and a half. I, at the time, was in a wheelchair and my whole body was in spasm and I was totally dependent on others helping me. When asked how much attention F80 paid to her at the time, she said he was connecting with my father, who he had been in the school with and also been my brother's headmaster. He was making that connection. My father later said that he and my mother had poured their hearts out to him about my situation and the misdiagnosis and my medical and, at the time, mental state and vulnerability. She said that F80 talked with her in the hospital in Lourdes every day, describing him as very gentle, very quiet, very unassuming and perfectly friendly. The EBC seems to think pretty highly of F80. In his evidence, Don Maidlow Davis described F80 as being a highly charismatic and appreciated chaplain within the school. He was good, if I can say that, in discussing issues that needed to be discussed with young people. And I remember on one occasion he brought in a married couple to talk about married life, and that was great. But as you'll remember, madam, the reality of F80 soon became apparent to the 17-year-old A117. He was a sexual predator, 35 years older than his victim, and he'd seen an opportunity. He saw a vulnerable, disabled, hospitalised and deeply unhappy teenager and took steps in his dealings with her and her parents to set up opportunities to sexually abuse her. One of the most striking parts of her evidence was the fact that her case, at the actual time she was being abused, was being passed between Cardinal Hume, who was appointed to his role by Rome, let's not forget, and the then headmaster of Downside, Philip Jebb. In 2007, by which time F80 was a head chaplain in the school, and it was clear that he posed a real risk to others, A117 felt she had to do something. She turned to the then abbot at Downside, Aidan Bellinger. She also sought help from Cardinal Hume's private secretary, Pat Brown. All of these men expressed sympathy to her face, but sought to do as little as possible behind the scenes. They all evaded taking her repeated complaints further, not just once or twice, but you'll remember for years, preferring to protect her abuser rather than providing her with the help and justice that she needed. And it's plain that if action had been taken when A117 first disclosed what was going on, when she was desperately asking for help, her abuse would have stopped almost immediately rather than being left to go on and on for all of those years. And for her to then be put straight into the hands of another abuser, as you'll remember. Instead, she was passed between these authority figures over decades, and over the course of that period, she felt, as she is described, increasingly ashamed, guilty, responsible, and periodically terrified. Those are the emotions that should have been felt by F80, not by her. The evidence given by Aidan Bellinger, both in response to her testimony and more generally, was simply not credible. All this inquiry needs to know about this man is that both the police and the Roman Catholic Church's own organisation, COPCA, considered him to have deliberately evaded assisting external investigations into allegations of sex abuse by monks. Whilst not going so far as to be at risk of arrest for obstruction of justice, all he could really say in his evidence was that he found it extraordinary that the police and COPCA described his evasions as they did. It does seem that Aidan Bellinger occupied that space between personal risk of arrest for obstruction and protecting those accused of abuse within the church very ably indeed. And his evidence has inevitably had a negative effect on A117. Those who haven't been abused can make the mistake of thinking that these are assaults that victims and survivors can put behind them, that they often occur decades ago, and as a result they have a lesser effect than in fact they do. It's worth remembering that child sexual abuse destroys lives. The psychological effect it generates, they're carried into adulthood. Guilt, embarrassment, humiliation, ongoing confusion and serious psychological disorders suffered commonly by those who are abused. The Roman Catholic Church has, in my submission, been guilty of forgetting of that reality. A117 was asked about how she felt while she was being abused by F80. Her answer wasn't unusual amongst those who suffered this sort of abuse. She said, "Very guilty. Very confused. It was different. It wasn't the sort of violent abuse I'd had in hospital. But Father Philip, who was becoming a friend at the same time and was not doing those things, made me realise even more how wrong it was." She She was asked how the effective lack of response from Cardinal Hume and others in the Catholic Church made her feel. She said, "At the time, I thought I was as guilty as F80. I was being made to feel that it was a sin rather than a crime against me. There was no outrage. It was like damage limitation between them." Moving on to A30 and the consequences upon her, she was brave enough to give evidence that she started to self-harm whilst being abused at Ampleforth. And the reason she gave for self-harming, again, is informative of the consequences of sexual abuse. She said, "I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to feel pain and if it's going to be bad, then I'm going to make sure that I control it. I do it to myself." And then that became a pattern. So what about my third area, the culture at Ampleforth and Downside? Well, the evidence before this inquiry shows that the culture within the EBC itself inhibits the prevention of this abuse. This is because the EBC, like the Roman Catholic Church more generally, is an institution that relies on its moral reputation to exist. That reputation is damaged when the public become aware that one of its monks has sexually abused a child in one of its institutions. Dr. Elizabeth Mann, who interviewed monks at both Ampleforth and Downside, summarises the position as follows. "Complaints at the time were silenced by the Catholic Church hierarchy. My research shows that monks were left to struggle in isolation with their personal problems of loneliness, anxiety about masturbation, identity foreclosure, identity confusion, and difficulties in intimacy. The monks in their formation were given no awareness or understanding of their sexuality or the sexual vulnerability of children." Dr. Mann's report isn't historic. It was based principally on research that she undertook in between 2003 and 2006. Now, the EBC may argue that its culture on child protection has changed, but it's clear that an us-v-them attitude abides within its institutions to this day. This isn't surprising. Liam Ring put it pretty clearly in his evidence. He said, "When you throw faith and religion into the mix in this context, it's quite a toxic mix in relation to trying to deal with safeguarding issues. The conversations I've had with victims, that they don't want to cause reputational damage, particularly to the school, is often their first consideration. But that extends to individuals and also to the Abbey and the church in general. So this desire to avoid reputational damage has been demonstrated in some shocking evidence over the last 3 weeks. I'll give you one example. Police officer Mark White has no axe to grind, and he's not got any colleagues to protect. He was just trying to do his job properly. One example of the steps taken to avoid this reputational damage came in his evidence of the brown envelopes that were kept under lock and key at Downside Abbey in the abbot's office. Officer White said, "Within the abbot's office there was a safe. When you asked for particular files, people had personnel files, but if there was anything negative or safeguarding issues or complaints, they were kept separate, again within brown envelopes. And the brown envelopes were kept within that safe in the abbot's office. So again, initially, they weren't given to us when we asked for the files from the priests. There wasn't one for each priest. I took that to mean that they weren't safeguarding issues raised in relation to each priest. We were unable to quantify which priests we had files for and which ones we didn't." That system sounds archaic. But the reality was, the existence of those brown envelopes, in which there were allegations of sexual abuse by specific monks, was discovered in an investigation in 2010. Aidan Bellinger's evidence in reply to the brown envelope observations was characteristic. He denied outright that they existed separately to the entire brown-sleeved files on each monk, and he said that the police were always given the complete file. When he was asked whether Officer White was lying about this, he said, "I think I gave all the files that were there in the abbot's office and archives to the police, and I can see absolutely no reason why I wouldn't do so." That was just one example. Aidan Bellinger's evidence to this inquiry was the evidence of evasion. Another example is what he said in relation to his failure to report F98. He said he didn't refer F98 to the authorities in 2013 when he was made aware of the allegation of F98 masturbating next to a pupil, quotes, "because he was dead." He said, "I meant to refer it. Sorry, this is a difficult one, because I thought I had referred it." There is no doubt about that. I was going to refer it and mention it, but the fact that he was dead probably meant that I put it aside for a moment and forgot it. It was then put to him that in 2012 he'd promised parents that any allegations that arose would be referred on, and he said, "I meant to keep that promise, and I'm sorry for not." So let's focus on what that evidence actually means. It seems to me it suggests one of two things. Either one, despite the promise he made in 2012 to the parents of the children at Downside, in 2013 the abbot put aside and then forgot to report the minor matter of a monk masturbating underneath his cassock next to a pupil. Or two, the former abbot of Downside deliberately broke a promise to parents by deliberately refusing to report a case of child sex abuse and then lied on oath to this inquiry about it. Either one is unacceptable. And it's not just Aidan Bellinger. Richard Yeo was another example of an abbot prioritising the welfare of his monks over the welfare of children in the church's care. Jane Jadulowitz said that when he was abbot, Richard Yeo was, quote, "very focused on monks and the clergy." And I feel very sad to say, I think his emphasis was more on protecting the clergy than it was victims. One example of this. Richard Yeo confirmed in his evidence that following Dunstan O'Keefe's prosecution for masturbating outside a primary school, he decided he wouldn't remove O'Keefe as novice master as he didn't see the need to, quote, "humiliate him more than necessary." It was only at Elizabeth Mann's urging that he contacted the police regarding the issues surrounding Mr. Dunstan O'Keefe in 2004. That was 7 years later. He was abbot president at the time. It was subsequently discovered that O'Keefe had downloaded 12,000 images and that only 2% of those were of adults. When Richard Yeo was asked if the rest of the images, other than that 2%, were of children, he said, "Well, including minors in their teens." As if that somehow makes it any better. So what should be done? Without meaningful recommendations from this inquiry, it seems entirely unlikely that canon law will ever be amended to mandate the reporting of safeguarding concerns to bodies outside the Roman Catholic Church. And even if it were, it's even less likely that they would be effectively enforced. Far more likely is that the Roman Catholic Church will continue to present the formal outward appearance of the paramount importance of safeguarding children from sexual abuse, whilst in practice doing nothing to stop the type of appalling behaviour that's gone on before. It doesn't matter whether its own internal safeguarding comes from staff at the schools rather than the priesthood. Both are influenced against reporting concerns because its monasteries and its fee-paying schools depend on moral reputation and money from their members for their survival. And the evidence of A30 shows with devastating force how simply piling internally generated safeguarding paperwork on top of the problem does little more than provide something for abusers to hide behind. The evidence of de Cogan's behaviour in alerting those in positions of authority at Ampleforth that A30 had a crush on him, yet for a long time thereafter chasing, tickling and pinging her bra strap in plain sight of staff, says all the panel needs to know about Ampleforth's attitude towards safeguarding to date. Again, this isn't an example from the 70s or 80s. This was going on in 2009. As for Downside, I've referred to Officer Mark White. He gave evidence of receiving complaints from a pupil at Downside that there was a monk, F80, who was known by those in power at Downside to have abused A117 for decades, as I've already said. But he was then permitted to talk openly in a school assembly, telling the girls, quotes, not to finger themselves, and telling the boys, quotes, to give up masturbation for Lent. Incredibly, this was just put down to F80 being F80. This was 4 years ago. It simply can't be permitted in the modern era. That, in my submission, says all this panel needs to know about purported internal improvements in safeguarding at Downside. Adrian Child summed up the position well in his evidence. He said, "I think the Catholic Church has had two excellent opportunities through Nolan and Cumberledge to get safeguarding right on a kind of goodwill internal basis. And whilst I think there's been a huge amount of effort by a lot of very good people, they haven't got it right, and that's in a 15-year period. So I don't see any value in tinkering around the edges and saying, here you are, here is a third opportunity, go away and sort this out yourself. I think there needs to be accountability and some kind of mandatory requirement." Attempts to change values don't change behaviour. Telling motorists that there's value in wearing a seatbelt didn't cause many people to wear seatbelts voluntarily. But when it was made law that they had to wear seatbelts, motorists started to judge one another for not doing so. Telling people not smoking in public places saves lives didn't stop smoking in pubs, but making it illegal against strong opposition caused a clear and prompt change in values. So in my submission, it's time for these institutions to be forced into the modern era by recommending that they be subject to clear mandatory reporting. Mandatory reporting works. Over 85% of countries in Europe and 90% of the countries in North and South America have some form of mandatory reporting. And there's no real evidence in these jurisdictions of authorities being swamped or inundated with spurious reports. And where it's been introduced in practice, there has been a subsequent change in values. People don't fear being criminalised for not reporting. They appreciate the fact that they're protected when they do report. So mandatory reporting will change the culture within these institutions, whether the Roman Catholic Church likes it or not. I've said that it was brought in America. On the 6th of September 2012, the New York Times reported that the Roman Catholic Bishop Robert Finn was found guilty of shielding a paedophile by failing to report child sex abuse. The paedophile in question had taken his laptop for repair and indecent images had been found. The paedophile, who was eventually convicted, admitted what he'd done to Bishop Finn, but was then sent by Finn to be sheltered at a different institution rather than being reported to the police, and his sexually inappropriate behaviour continued as a result. So what's this inquiry for? It's an opportunity to do something. Its terms of reference do provide you with the power to publish recommendations, and those recommendations are, in my submission, going to carry real force. Any recommendations you do make, madam, should consider the recommendations that have, by coincidence, just been published this morning by the Australian Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sex Abuse. There were 189 new recommendations, one of which was that religious ministers should be forced to report child sex abuse that had been revealed to them in confessionals. I'd like to end with a quote from A117. She was asked if there was anything she wanted to add at the end of her evidence, and she said this: "I think it's been 35 years getting to this point. I never wanted to speak of these things again. I thought the police investigation was closure. I think abuse by anybody is devastating and damaging, but those that deny it or put a convenient spin on it just shatter your life. I still don't have closure. That goes on, I think, seeing Abbot Aidan's description of my abuse a few weeks ago, where he described in one sentence F80's extramural sexual activity. When he saw that I was here today, he submitted a 10-page extra statement justifying himself and trying to discredit my evidence. I think what's not working is that the Church is continuing to be judge and jury. I believe that safeguarding should be mandatory. I believe that those who cover up abuse and put a convenient spin on it should be accountable. It's really hurt that I've had to listen to the old boy network trash what I've been through. I've had to read letters of outrage. I've had to be in a room where outrage is expressed, not for the victims, but for the monk. There's a lot of anger towards people like safeguarding professionals and the police. These old boys and parents of children in the school should be grateful to these people. It's the police and the safeguarding that have made these children safer, not the men who are running these schools. I believe you need third parties overseeing this, and that safeguarding should be mandatory. Thanks very much."